crazy. Those guys are retards.
Comedy alive from New York City. It's the Off the Meter radio program. What you're listening to, you're probably familiar with by now. It's a vacation week here on Off the Meter Radio. We're on vacation. I'm out in Ohio chasing my kid around, you know, some type of dairy establishment, trying to avoid having sex with my wife. Because when my wife gets on vacation, it's you're not having sex. That's the point.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's a scene from Gladiator.
Right.
And a deleted scene from Gladiator, something they couldn't even show in the Coliseum.
Sure,
she's a rough gal. And when she gets back to the Midwest, she grew up on a dairy farm.
Formidable.
Formidable. You know what it's like? It's like I have sex with this woman year-round, but when we go to Ohio, it's like when Rocky starts training in Russia.
Oh,
you know,
really?
Running up the mountain in the snow and doing those odd feats of strength.
What is it about being home? Because that's where she's from, right?
Yeah, that's what it is. It's a home game.
It's a home game.
People play with a little more pride. They got a little more pep in their step, and I think that's what it is. But the voice you hear alongside of me, Dean Imperial, a man who is now a permanent co-host of the show. Look at you, man. You've arrived in life.
I know,
you've
right?
You've really made it. But what we've been doing on the show this week, if you're not familiar, is because I was away, we wanted to provide you, the listener, with some content. Mostly because I have a book coming out and I need to continue whoring it out.
Sure, yeah.
Because it is available for pre-order on BarnesandNoble.com and Amazon.com and IndieBound. So what I did this week is I recorded a series of interviews with people I find fascinating, interesting people I like talking to. We started the week, Dean, you helped me.
Yeah.
The Monday episode was Carl Gottlieb.
Which was a great interview, yeah.
Writer of The Jerk, writer of Jaws. He could have been the head writer of Saturday Night Live in its inaugural season, but he turned it down.
He actually turned it down, yeah.
Because he was that happening. Can you imagine you, the listener, being so happening that you could turn down head writer for Saturday Night Live? He did it, and it worked out for him.
Yeah, and Jaws, I think Jaws had happened right before it premiered, so it was right around that time. But, like, what could beat Jaws? I mean, first blockbuster in history.
The man's responsible for the term summer blockbuster. So, basically, we had Carl on one day. Then I went through a series of interviews, a couple of rough ones. I had Nick Leffley on, who is the executive editor for Maxim magazine.
Yeah.
He's British. He's a drunk.
<That's>...
Like, you are just that was the drunkest interview I've ever done, because these interviews, you, the listener, are not in our traditional time slot. We're not doing the news today.
Mm-hmm.
We're just giving you extra content because we care about you, and of course, because we don't have anything we could call a best of.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have the balls. Some, you know, some guys are comfortable doing that when they're out of the office. They're like, it's the best of Opie and Anthony or
right,
whatever,
right.
Or Howard Stern,
right.
And good for them. They make money. They're great at what they do.
Uh-huh.
We don't have that level of ego on this show.
No.
I mean, we believe the hook of this show is just how mediocre it is. Like, we're very self-aware people. Part of our appeal is that we make anyone listening believe they could host a radio show.
Yeah.
And the other part is that, you know, we don't take ourselves seriously. We're not best of.
No.
Kill yourself.
Right.
You start, you know, speaking of yourself in reverential tones. So basically what I've done this week is we interviewed Gottlieb, we interviewed Nick Leffley, and that was the drunkest interview I've ever done, because we recorded that at 11 o'clock on a Thursday night. I was getting ready to walk over and close a TV taping, and the grounds for these interviews is I was able to entice people to do them at strange hours when I was available by promising them like a meal or a drink or whatever it was they wanted to come in.
Sure.
Leffley, being a British drunk hooligan, wanted a couple of 12-packs, and we got loaded.
Oh, yeah.
No motor skills. If you didn't hear that interview, you can backtrack. It's me with no motor skills. I took away my own keys. Like 5 minutes into the interview, we stumbled through it. We then had Mike Edison on, who was the former editor-in-chief of Screw Magazine.
That's great. That sounds like a great interview.
Yeah. We're talking about porn with Al Goldstein and the reason he hates Hugh Hefner. And he told me the famous Bob Guccione story of a guy who had gazillions of dollars, blew it all, and wound up almost homeless for a little while there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we got into that. He went on to become the publisher of High Times magazine.
Okay, so he's staying in a certain niche.
Yeah, he's found a niche.
Market.
Which segued really well to the Thursday guest, Jenny Fallon.
Oh, yeah.
So if you've been listening all week, and all of those available, all those episodes are available in our feed. What were you going to say?
It's like a Charlie Rose week. You're doing your Charlie Rose.
So if you've been listening all week, you've heard four pretty interesting interviews, if I do say so myself. And we are now at what we would call the light at the end of the tunnel. Dean Imperial, the man who is now a full-time co-host of this show.
Mm-hmm.
A show that's about to make major news and announce a change in our broadcast platform starting in September.
That's right.
Starting in September, we're going to be doing something a little bit different. You, the listener, are now going to be able to hear the show for 2 hours a day. Most of you who aren't hearing it live will now all be able to hear it live. You'll all be able to call in live instead of just getting our Google Voice line. You'll be able to have your voices heard on the air.
Yeah.
You'll be able to listen to it in your car,
mm-hmm.
listen to it on your phone,
mm-hmm.
listen to it anywhere in the world. This mediocrity is now going to be there for you everywhere you go.
Right. There'll be an event kind of atmosphere to it.
So for those of you who just listen to us for a self-esteem boost, you're in luck, man. You're mm-hmm. going to have us around the clock to feel better about yourself. So what I'm doing with Dean is what I've done with all of these other guests this week. As I'm doing kind of like a getting to know you. We're kind of just walking through people's lives, having some conversations about them, giving you a little backstory on the guest, and that's really all it is. It is not Off the Meter with Jimmy Failla today. We're basically doing an Off the Meter with Dean Imperial, the man you hear in your ear right now. So let's go through a few of these. And don't read my outline, you scumbag.
Okay, I won't. I'm not going to read your outline.
Not that there's any element of surprise. I'm asking you questions about you.
Okay.
Ooh, I got a bone up.
I know,
on
but
that
I'd rather not. I don't want to anticipate.
Well, we should let's start
keep
basic.
This spontaneous.
We should
this is
start
an exciting
basic.
Interview already.
Shut the hell up, will you?
But and thank you for coming in.
Oh, you're welcome.
And it should be noted the enticements that I had to make to get guests so far to get everyone up to speed.
Right.
Carl Gottlieb just wanted to plug his book because he's a nice guy, very generous with time. Gave us like a 48-minute interview.
Yeah,
we asked for 15, he gave us 48.
Right.
Nick Leffley just wanted me to drink like I was pledging a fraternity.
That's cool.
Mike Edison actually wanted a Twix, which I found interesting. He demanded a Twix. I said, of all the candy bars in the world, why a Twix? And we didn't get into it on the air because it was like almost too profound. It had to do with the relationship he was just in.
Uh-huh.
And it was kind of synonymous with something that had gone on. He wasn't in the best place about it, so we didn't delve into it on the air.
Wow, that's a lot of...
your basic enticement, though, at this point is just food. You're just hungry.
Yeah, I'm hungry, but you know.
All right, but no, it was good. I got lucky because I didn't wind up in a situation where anybody really raked me over the coals.
No.
And for you, this is just going to end in an Olympian amount of carbohydrates.
Sure.
And of course, Dean is a pivotal character in my new book, Follow That Car, that you'll buy and read all about. But today is not about the book. Today is about you, sir.
Uh-huh.
We should start in New Jersey. You grew up in New Jersey, right?
I did. I grew up in New Jersey, in Randolph, New Jersey,
Randolph.
Which is about an hour outside of the city.
It's nice because it's like close enough that you can get here at any moment, but far enough that you don't hear the gunshots.
Yeah, there you go.
Because you're 36 like me.
Yeah.
So the city you grew up coming to...
was the same city that you used to see when you were growing up.
Let me explain it to you this way. We're 36. When we came to the city as kids, it looked like Detroit does today.
Right.
New York City in the 1980s was mm-hmm. Detroit in the year 2013.
Absolutely. You'd come into Times Square and it was full of crime.
It was all crime and it was hookers. I mean, mm-hmm. you had to love that. I love that.
Oh, God. That was the greatest. I remember my father used to drive us in as a family.
Uh-huh.
And the way my family dynamic was really weird. Like, you could have my little sister in the car, my mother and I. And I would say we would actually drive as a family looking for hookers because my father knew. One of my greatest memories of all time is his father was in the car. It was his father and who had had a stroke. So he was like debilitated, but he still had a great sense of humor. So it was Father's Day and it was my father, my grandfather, my mother, my sister and I who are kids, little kids. We're 10 years old. And my father drove us around the city until we saw hookers. And we found two hookers peeing behind a car. And we looked and we laughed. And then they got up and cursed us out. And we all laughed as a family uproariously and drove away.
It's not.
A little window into my upbringing.
Well, it's a human safari.
Yeah.
I will tell you this in regards to hookers. The first hooker I ever saw, it was a Yankee Stadium in the 80s, 1985. I was leaving a Yankee game. And a hooker, we were by the Bronx Terminal Market. And we weren't there for the express purpose of seeing hookers. We were there to go home.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I grew up in a law enforcement family who frowned upon it, which means they were buying hookers.
Uh-huh.
You know, the people that are that judgmental of it are doing it.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
But a hooker approached our car, and I had the presence of mind as a 7-year-old kid to say, anybody got a 50? I'm not even kidding. And my mom, little Marianne Fela, slapped me in the face.
Oh, really?
My first time getting smacked by my mom.
Oh, man.
So I said, anybody got a 50? My dad laughed.
That's hilarious.
My dad laughed and jotted down the location. So it's funny, though, that we both had, and this was something we bonded on back when we first met.
Yeah, because we have all the same cultural references, too, yeah. And it's because we're almost exactly the same age.
Yeah.
We're a month apart.
And we went to the Triple Treat Theater.
Mm-hmm.
There was a place, ladies and gentlemen, called the Show World Triple Treat Theater, where anything went on. There was a thing called live sex shows back then.
Yeah.
You could physically walk in, pay $5, and watch two people have sex on stage. And not necessarily people. You could watch
one person
and something else.
Yeah.
You could watch someone alone.
Right.
You could watch a zoo exhibit.
Yeah.
You could watch anything. And you, like me, were one of the people who liked that.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a weird thing, but would you agree with me on this? It's not even a sexual thing. There's just something about it that's so out there.
I would say too, for me though, there was like there. It's so out there, but there was a sexual component.
Yeah,
too.
It's like a little older.
Yeah.
But by the time I was like 12, okay, I was sneaking into the city for one reason.
Yeah.
You know, to go to the Triple Treat Theater. They had these things called buddy booths, and what a buddy booth was for you, the listener, is you would basically go into a booth that was similar to meeting someone in prison. There was a glass between you and a woman.
Uh-huh.
You'd pick up a phone and talk, and as you tipped through the glass, she would do sexual things to her body.
Oh, yes. I've read about that in the Bible.
But I'm not kidding.
Like,
would be, and this is going to sound lewd, but you'd be sitting on a stool, and on the other side of the glass, there was a woman with a dildo doing what you told her.
Yeah.
And for a 12-year-old kid,
Whoa.
You know, let's be fair.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
It was insane.
But the point is, it blew your mind.
Totally blows your mind.
So we had that backstory, and that was part of the reason we bonded when we met, because you came from Jersey, I came from Long Island, but we were now working in Times Square at the world-famous
Ha Comedy Club.
Ha Comedy Club.
Yep.
And I don't know how I could explain the Ha Comedy Club to you, the listener. But
it came at a time when stand-up comedy in New York City, it was like the barking boom.
Yes,
I think not that there wasn't barking before that,
mm-hmm.
but there was something about that moment there right after 9/11 where comedy like kind of revived itself,
mm-hmm.
and you and I were part of that team that after the Bringer shows.
Yeah, let me explain this to the audience. What we were doing at this point, we were barking, and what barking means is, as a beginner comic, you get asked to stand out in Times Square
mm-hmm.
and hand out flyers to entice people into the show.
Yeah.
And what the Ha Comedy Club did is, because there was such a tourism boom post 9/11, because I guess people felt sympathetic, they wanted to see Ground Zero, whatever it was. But 9/11 is almost single-handedly responsible for that tourism resurgence that repurposed the city.
Yeah.
Because the city's whole economy is predicated on it now. And the Ha Comedy Club, it's an interesting story. They were a piano bar called Sweet Caroline's.
Yeah.
And they had a guy by the name of Exine, who, if you've never met Exine,
a character to end all characters.
If there was only going to be one human in the Star Wars cantina, and it was Exine, I think the universe would all be okay.
Right.
Because he belongs in the Star Wars cartina. He's a gay man.
Yeah.
He's kind of, I mean, some people would say he plays a little loose with the facts.
Yeah.
Pete Dominic once famously described him as saying he looks like someone who's already died of AIDS. That was Pete Dominic's line.
What the hell did you say?
That's funny.
Was Pete Dominic's line. And he was Exine. But what happened was Exine approached this piano bar and said, I want to do an open mic here.
Uh-huh.
And they said, okay, you can have like Wednesday night. And he decided to go outside and hand out flyers. Like, hey, we're doing a comedy show down the street.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was the tourism was such that he started getting a crowd. And not like 20 or 30 people, like a few hundred people.
Yeah.
So it went in the course of like 2 or 3 weeks from one guy hosting an open mic to Sweet Caroline's hosting 7 comedy shows a week. And then ultimately 6 or 7 comedy shows a night, 7 nights a week.
Right.
Within like a matter of a month, it went from an open mic to a comedy club that was now getting sued by Caroline's on Broadway.
Yeah.
For having a derivative name.
Yep.
And it then became the Ha Comedy Club, and ultimately what I consider to be the greatest land of misfit toys in comedy history.
Oh yeah, and the most fun I've ever had in my life.
Best time of my life. Dean and I were sitting on stage. sitting on stage. We were sitting out in Times Square for an hour at a time.
On 46th Street. I was in the when Howard Johnson's was still open.
On the tail end of old Times Square because it hadn't gone straight Olive Garden yet.
Right.
It was safer. It was nicer. It was a lot of TGI Fridays and stuff like that.
It still had some attitude.
But they still had things like Barcode.
Yeah.
Which was just like a thug game room.
Mm-hmm.
Which was, kind of like a descendant of old Times Square where they had those game rooms with the street gangs in them and the shootings and the stabbings and the drugs and the confidence schemes. Old Times Square was Amsterdam.
Exactly.
It was straight Amsterdam.
Yeah.
There were hookers everywhere. You could buy weapons in broad daylight. You could buy drugs on every street corner.
Mm-hmm.
If nobody was looking, you could pay a cop like $20 to use his gun for like a few minutes and bring it back. It was depraved. It was a lawless region. And every Broadway theater that you know on 42nd Street was shuttered.
Yeah.
And they had all kinds of like biblical prophecies and stuff on the billboards.
Uh-huh.
They'd have like a Bible saying or, the end is near, or save yourself.
Yep.
And they were just hookers hanging out in front of them. It was basically Taxi Driver.
It was Taxi Driver.
What you saw in the movie uh-huh. Taxi Driver was Old Times Square. And Dean and I got to the Ha Comedy Club at the very, very end of Old Times Square.
Yep.
We were handing out flyers and not only getting to hang out in Times Square, which is the coolest thing in the world, but then we were doing comedy.
We would be outside for like an hour and a half. We'd get the crowd in,
uh-huh.
and then we'd run. Jim and I would run back to the comedy club, and we'd perform. And like we always, I remember that they always either put you first and me second, or me first and you second.
Yeah, because we had a good energy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So we were always there. So we were always on the same schedule.
Yeah, 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 yeah. That went on. So we were kind of like co-conspirators.
Yeah.
On the barking front, Dean had the south side of 46th Street. The southwest side of 46 and Broadway.
I was on the north.
Oh, because you were by Hojo's?
I was not by Hojo's.
We would flip a lot. I was going to say, because my first time meeting you, you were on the south. You were walking that big, wide sidewalk in front of the Marriott.
Oh, wow. Yeah, because it changed up a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah.
I was by Howard Johnson's, and I only know it was there because I have a famously weak and temperamental bladder. And I went to. I always tried to get Howard Johnson's.
Oh,
there.
They had that
side door bathroom you could
sneak
into.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
And back then, I was bringing chicks in there.
Uh-huh.
And then we were living good. So Dean and I basically met at a high point for both of us because we were like a year into comedy. We were flyering to get on stage. And in between handing out flyers and telling jokes, we were meeting wayward women in Times Square.
Oh, yeah.
And things were happening.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not bragging about any of those things.
No.
And we're very thankful for the fact that this was before the age of the surveillance camera.
Right.
Because this show would be taking place from a prison.
Right.
Or at least some type of home rehabilitation center. So we're thankful for that. But that's kind of the entree into this. But in between doing that and getting into comedy, they should also know, like, you worked on a Howard Stern show.
I did. I was an intern on the Howard Stern show when I was in college. It was the first internship. I went to college at Fordham at Lincoln Center.
Uh-huh.
I came to New York City to go to college.
Uh-huh.
I just wanted to be in the city. And so and right away I realized that the classes were, like, totally worthless.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? So I got an internship on the Howard Stern show, which at the time was pretty tough. It was right when the movie had come out.
Oh, Private Parts.
So he was huge.
Okay.
And it was really hard to get. And everybody there was a big celebrity, so it was like kind of – it was a lot to take in, And I worked there for a semester, and I got in really – he used to have me on the air, and he really liked me because I was a really hard worker. And I started – I pulled a stunt.
Uh-huh.
I started showing up there wearing a tie, and I told my father this. I said, "I watch me get attention for just showing up. I'm going to carry a pad everywhere. And write everything down and wear a tie. I'm going to be the only guy who wears a tie." And sure enough, it was the day he had Michael Richards in, Kramer.
Really?
Yeah. And he actually, after Kramer, was like, because what happened was that they put me in charge of taking care of Michael Richards. And
uh-huh.
I said, "Would you like something to drink, Mr. Richards?" And he said, "Yeah, I'll take an orange juice." I said, and then with my pad, I said, "Okay, so you want it with pulp or without pulp? Do you want it like one of those mixed with tangerine? What do you want?" And he was like, "Oh, just regular is fine." So I wrote down, "Okay, just regular." So I ran and got it. And then somehow that Gary saw that or somebody saw that and they communicated it to him. And then after Michael Richards left, he called me on the air and he said, "So who are you? Like, what are you writing everything down?" And he's got a tie. He's wearing a tie. He's showing up here. This guy could be the producer. And he said, "Gary, come in here."
I said, "Do you see what this guy's doing?"
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and he had me on the air for, and he was like, I was like a god around there for a while.
So you were sitting on the air with Howard Stern. What year is this?
Oh, this is 98, 98 or 97.
Wow, and you'd have to say from a radio standpoint, it's been all uphill from there.
I know, right?
Here you are with me.
I know, right?
Wow, you've really made it happen. Yeah. No, that's funny. But I mean, did that blow your mind? That had to blow your mind.
Oh, it did. At the time, it totally blew my mind. And then he kind of would have me on all the time. Yeah, I would come in on pretty regularly, and I was on there with Siskel and Ebert, and that was actually on the television show.
On the Stern Show.
On the Stern Show, and everybody saw it.
That's
yeah.
funny that as a kid, I could have probably watched you on TV.
Oh, I'm sure you did.
And I might have defrauded one of your out-of-state relatives on a nefarious telemarketing
right.
sale.
Yeah.
That blows my mind, man, to think that. And a shout-out to Howard Stern, because we say this a lot. You know, we're not like personal friends of the guy.
No, but we like
him. We don't
him.
Get to listen to the show as much.
Yeah.
But we had an interaction with him doing America's Got Talent this summer.
Uh-huh.
You were there at my taping of the Hammerstein
Ballroom. I was.
And you have to say, in the way he reacts to not just me, just anybody.
Yeah.
He's giving you constructive, thought-out feedback.
Oh, yeah.
And he's pointing at you at an angle that none of the other judges see.
Absolutely.
They all give you something very entry-level and superficial.
Mm-hmm.
He actually somehow manages in one sentence to get inside your soul.
Yeah.
And question you. And that's why, to me, it had to be – there couldn't be anything more fascinating than being in a studio with him. That had to be amazing.
Well,
but it didn't stop there. You went to Charlie Rose.
Yeah. After that, I wanted to balance out my resume just because I had the Howard Stern show on there. So I decided to balance it out with like an interview program.
Uh-huh.
And that was like a little bit more high-end. This was on – but he interviewed all of these famous people.
But now let me say this. I want to stop you there for 1 second. Because you did Stern, you did Charlie Rose, and people have seen the movie Private Parts.
Uh-huh.
Naked women, celebrities, chicks everywhere. But the booze intake on the Stern show compared to the Charlie Rose show, non-existent, right?
Well, what do you mean? Meaning
how much drinking is going on the Stern show?
Oh, drinking like,
yeah,
you know.
Alcohol.
Alcohol? Like, well, probably just as much as the Charlie Rose show, because Charlie.
No, I'm saying, I was going to say, who Stern isn't drinking at all.
No, he's not drinking.
But Charlie Rose.
Well, listen, I, with all due respect to Charlie Rose, because he was always cool.
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't ever know the intern's names,
uh-huh,
but that's fine.
Uh-huh.
But there was, you know, I can't prove this,
uh-huh,
but the staff at the time, uh-huh, used to make jokes saying that he had a few too many glasses of wine before he would come in and interview.
What time was the show taped?
5 or 6 o'clock in the evening, sometimes
okay,
4. Like,
okay,
he did like a 4 o'clock to 7 o'clock thing. Sometimes he would record maybe 3 or 4 interviews in a night. Sometimes he would do just one.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I mean, it's sometimes you'd interview something if it was timely, like, yeah, and sometimes he would do it live.
Oh, wow.
Very rarely, but he would do something
probably
live.
Probably on the sober nights.
Probably on... It would have to be on the sober nights. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They
used to laugh because, like, you know, sometimes he kind of trips over his words.
Uh-huh.
And, like, they used to laugh when he had Kevin Spacey in. This,
uh-huh,
was a crazy Kevin Spacey experience, because I talked to Kevin Spacey for, like, a good 45 minutes.
Cool dude.
Very cool dude. We talked movies. We talked The Last Detail. We talked, wow, Jack Lemmon.
Wow.
I met Jack Lemmon on there, too. And like,
you met
he was
Jack Lemmon.
I met Jack Lemmon. Talked to Jack Lemmon about movies.
Shelley the Machine Levine?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, so anyway, but they used to laugh because he kept tripping up his intro. So he tripped up his intro so many times that the producer was like, this is so embarrassing. You know, because he used to get on the camera and he'd do that intro where he'd be like, Kevin Spacey is here. He was a film Mike. I'm going to have to do that again. Right? And then he would do it literally like 5 or 6 times in a row. And then they had to finally just move on and figure, well, you just have to take the best one because this poor man is sitting there in the studio.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But Kevin Spacey was cool, and everyone I met there was cool.
Wow. It's fascinating, that background. Because while you were doing that, I, of course, was famously telemarketing on Long Island.
Hey, listen, we're both here in this room right now.
Somehow
these, you know, the roads.
There's an odd symmetry to the
yeah,
case.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It all became the same highway at some point.
All roads lead to 23rd and 6th at the age of 36. Sometimes here we are. At the time you were doing Stern and Charlie Rose, I had a no-show telemarketing job.
Oh, yeah.
This is one of my – we've probably never gotten into this, but a guy, Big Lou –
uh-huh.
And that's all you need to know about the story. There's a guy named Big Lou involved.
Period.
Any type of decency or moral upstanding is thrown right out the window.
With somebody named Big Lou, yeah.
What's this no last name involved, period?
Yeah.
Credibility is kind of in the muck. And what happened was Big Lou was an interesting story because he and I were captains of a high school football team one year.
Uh-huh.
And his dad was a bookmaker. And I didn't know that. But I called up his dad. I called up his house looking for Louie at 6 o'clock at night. I said, yeah, is Louie there? He said, yeah, who's this? I said, it's Jimmy. He said, oh, hey, Jimmy, tough one on the Knicks last night. And it took me a second to process it, but he goes, tough one on the Knicks. What can I get you? And I didn't even know it meant bookmaking.
I was just so startled.
I go, oh, I think I'm looking for your son. And he goes, oh, I'm so sorry. Here you go. And he hands it to the kid. And he goes, it's for you. He goes, hurry up. And I was like, oh, man. And then Big Lou got on the phone and he said, yeah, yeah, my dad's taking bets right now. I got to go.
Oh, man.
And so Big Lou just hangs up flat out. And that's the precursor to the story is that summer, after being a co-captain on a football team that famously never won a game,
because
I was a good captain.
Oh, sounds good.
Big Lou called me up and said, how would you like a job selling rare coins? And I said, I don't really know anything about rare coins. He's like, you don't need to. He goes, because they're so rare that the people buying them never receive them.
I'm calling the cops.
I was like, what are you talking about?
That's amazing.
And he's like, yeah, yeah, my dad lined up a job for the two of us at this telemarketing outfit. They're going to be selling coins to people all over the country, and they don't even really ship the coins. I was like, wait, Louie, we're going to get killed for this. He's like, no, we're not. He goes, because we're not going to be there when they come shoot up the office. I go, what do you mean? He goes, I had never heard the term before. He goes, it's a no-show telemarketing job.
Oh, that is absolutely amazing.
They just need an underage kid that they can write a check to every month. You're going to cash it. You're going to keep like 80% of it, and you're just going to give them the other 20% in cash.
So why an underage kid?
Because you couldn't be prosecuted. They were trying to minimize. I mean, these were real organized criminals.
That's genius.
So
you know, I hear that, and I'm like, that is absolute complete genius.
I was 16 years old, and I was suddenly making $400 a week.
Oh, God.
Without going to work.
Oh, my God.
Without going to work. But the woman who I had to meet on Friday to cash the checks, who was the mastermind, who was the salesman, was a legitimate, and I'm not exaggerating, she was a legitimate 400-pound woman. Now, you know this.
Yeah.
400 pounds for a woman is like 650 pounds for a man.
Oh, yeah.
She was a 400-pound woman. She wore orthopedic shoes.
Mm-hmm.
You know those people that are so fat they don't wear shoes. They wear, it almost looks like mouse traps on either foot.
Yeah,
like square mouse traps.
Yeah. They have their own like platform thing.
And
yeah.
And she had a boyfriend who's, I guess, some type of a chubby chaser. He was a bone skinny guy. Because 500-pound women, if they have boyfriends, they're always 80 pounds.
Yeah.
She had a bone skinny guy, a real nasty prick that would give us a hard time and curse us out. But we would go there every Friday and collect our 40-hour paycheck gigs we didn't do. And what happened was, it was a great summer. It was like 8 weeks long. I made $3,200.
That's incredible.
And on the Friday of Labor Day weekend, I showed up on a Friday, and it's so great. I show up on a Friday to this Numis group. That's what it was called. It was in like a rundown office building in Levittown next to the deli we used to hang out at in high school. And there's like five police cars. And I don't know what they're doing in the building. But based on my work history that summer, I decide it's probably not in my best interest to walk
in the door.
Now, mind you, I'm riding a bicycle to this exchange.
Right.
I'm riding a bicycle to collect this no-show mafia construction money. And she comes walking out in handcuffs doing a perp walk as I just sit there drinking in the spectacle. She doesn't see me. The guy comes out behind her, the chubby chaser, also taking a perp walk. But the magic of this whole thing is that she gets thrown in a cop car, and 3 minutes later, the Chinese delivery guy knocks on the cop car window and holds up the food she ordered.
Oh, my God.
Like, you know how we always joke about how the Chinese guy will deliver in rain, sleet, or hail,
snow? Yeah.
We knew Hurricane Katrina was serious when the Chinese guy shut down.
Yeah, I mean, doesn't matter if she's in the back
He knocked. You talk about that stereotype perpetuated. This is 1993, 1992. He knocked on the door.
Wow.
Like, hey, you got this lo mein here. Who's paying for this?
Right.
Like, he wasn't giving up on the sale. The point is, it was $3.85 worth of lo mein. That, ladies and gentlemen, is why they're more successful than us.
Absolutely. Every little penny counts. Yeah.
An American-raised kid, straight American, lazy white teenager like me, sees her get let out in cuffs, opens the brown paper bag, removes the staple, and eats the lo mein.
Wow.
That's exactly what goes on.
I agree with that.
Can I ask you a question? How many years were you on the football team? I didn't know you were on the football team.
4 years.
You were on all 4 years.
I quit as a high school senior.
Yeah.
We'll do this quickly. Because someone offered me a job that's kind of now famous in the lore of Jimmy Fallon, is that a different kid got me a job working for one of those shows where you give out gambling advice.
Mm-hmm.
Completely from top to bottom a fraud, but we didn't know this. I did that job for 10 years, and basically what this entailed was people were calling you up asking you who to bet on.
Mm-hmm.
And you were basically telling them you knew who to bet on because you had information, you had these people, you could change their lives, you could make them money.
Yeah.
Because we didn't know. We were the perfect kids to hire, that they didn't know what they were doing.
Right.
So you have to understand, when you get hired to work a job like that, the guy hiring you sells you exactly how you sell a customer.
Mm-hmm.
We have information that nobody else has.
Right. They get you to work for them.
We're going to make money.
Right.
Because everybody you call and sell this information to is going to win. They're mm-hmm. going to pay you. You're going to get laid.
Right.
You're going to have some fun. In any event, it's going to be so crazy. Why don't you take the weekend on us before you start the job? Here's my Mercedes. Here's $1,000. Here's a girl. Show up on Monday if you want more of this. That was the exact pitch.
Wow, that's...
senior year in football.
I take that now.
Oh, God! Oh, you have no idea. As a 17-year-old kid, 95% body fat. Again, my head, I had the type of big head that you could charge people to look at in the back door.
Yeah.
And it, exactly what it was. It was like, yeah, here's a girl. I'm not even kidding. Here's a girl, Jill. Jill and the Mercedes and you, here's $1,000. Go have a weekend in the city. If you think it's fun, come back on Monday because this is going to be the rest of your life, kid.
Oh, my God.
So I didn't go straight to the city. I went over to Division Avenue High School.
Uh-huh.
Flagged down my coach and was like, my hip hurts.
While sitting in the car.
I went over there.
Sitting in the Mercedes with the window down. Hey, listen, coach, can I talk to you a second?
While I'm getting filleted under the steering wheel. I don't think I'm going to make practice this week. All right, well, how about tomorrow? No, I don't think I'm going to make tomorrow either.
Oh, man.
So the point is, that was the end of me. That was the end of my athletic career, and it became 10 years of flying back and forth to Vegas with people that were betting untold amounts of money, $50,000 a game, $100,000 a game. I had a guy betting $1 million a game.
Oh, my God.
And the thing about these guys, which is amazing, is a guy who bets $1 million a game and loses, you're like, oh, my God, I'm going to die. You're not going to die because that guy's used to losing.
Yeah.
Guys that are career gamblers lose every night of the week.
Right, they're used
to
it.
So the losing never drives them crazy. What drives them crazy is the lack of action.
Mm-hmm.
If you lose a guy $1 million, he's only as mad as it takes you to say, we got another game.
Yep.
So what happened to me is the money, the chicks, all of that stuff. I was, famously living at home with my mom. I had a Mercedes S-Class, $100,000 car, an Acura NSX, like a $200,000 car, custom built for me. It was like, that scene in Blow where it cuts from like the Pinto to the garage with the 12 cars outside of it in Nicaragua?
Sure.
I was doing that, living at home with my mom. And it's like, all the way through my 20s, it was a really wild time. And it took me till I was about 25 to realize, like, we didn't really know what we were doing.
Right.
Like, you were losing for people all the time, but the money was still coming in. And you were saying to yourself, wow, the boss must be in a slump. We've lost 100 in a row.
Wow.
He must not be too good at this. But it was, it's just the sleaziest, scammiest, bottom-feeding industry I've ever been around. But my favorite people on earth.
Sure,
The people that worked in that industry. Because you know who they were? They were the modern incarnate of those guys in Times Square, those confidence men who played shell games under the hat, who sold you a DVD box with a slate in it.
Well, they were genuine. There's something about hanging around with a genuine character.
Yes.
Like a person who's somebody who seems like they walked right out of a novel.
Yeah, that's exactly who they were.
You know?
Mr. Ferris. I had a guy who used to call me and say, hey, we got Mr. Ferris on the line. He's a big wheel down at the carnival.
I mean, that's a line in a book.
And that's where I famously heard the hat story.
Oh, yeah. I love that story.
If you don't know this story, I had a guy who was such a degenerate gambler. He had lost such a prodigious amount of money that he had now been reduced to paying his bills each month by putting them in a hat and pulling out one bill. Because they all averaged between, $80 and $120. And he was famously doing that because he was so addicted to games of chance. This is as much about him being broke as it is everything had to be action. So he couldn't just pick a bill and pay it or rotate. He had to have that game a chance because he was addicted to the action.
Right.
But the point was he obviously didn't have the money either. And a bill collector caught up to him at work. They found his phone number and lit into him and cursed him out. And his big closer was, oh, yeah? Well, just for that, "You're not going in the hat this month," and hung up the phone on the guy. Good. And I sincerely doubt the bill collector had any idea what he was talking about. But to be there, it was at equal times the saddest and funniest thing I've ever seen.
That's amazing.
And that guy, I have no idea where he is, but I guess he's dead.
Yeah, gotta be, right?
He was living crazy. He was living crazy. Our last interaction, we were coming home from the city, and he called up an escort service. I dropped him off drunk at our office, like 3:30 in the morning, and left with him on the phone going like, "Hi, I need a girl.
Can
I get a girl?" And then when I shut the door, I sat there and put my ear against the door, and he's like, and if you don't have any and you got a guy, that's fine.
Oh my God.
And I was like, yep. That's exactly who he was.
Yeah, one of those nights.
And that, yeah. You know those nights. You know those nights. So the point is, I left that business because I had always wanted to do stand-up comedy. Money, Benzes, chicks. I always wanted to do stand-up comedy. My parents had gotten divorced, and I wanted my mom to have something to do. Mm-hmm. I got into stand-up comedy because my best childhood friend, Steve Robbins, who's a baseball player his whole life, captain of the baseball team, all-county player, decided to act when he went to college.
He did?
He went into theater for 2 years in college.
Are you serious?
He was obsessed with TV and movies and decided to act.
Oh, wow.
And I was watching him at his first play on a Friday night.
You went to go see him in a play?
Yeah, they were doing The Lion in the Winter.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they did that one. And then they did one with, I got to think of this, like something like three women wearing the same dress or something like that.
Oh, three tall women?
Yeah, something like that.
Okay.
But the point is, he was in a few plays, but at that first Friday night, I saw his mom in the front row. Like, she's a great friend of mine. I was talking to her. And I was like, wow, this is so cool that his divorced mom has, like, somewhere cool to go on the weekends now. And say, like, wow, you know, this is cool. I'm going to go out and see my son perform tonight. And that was, like, actually my puritanical motivation to do stand-up comedy.
Well, I got to ask you something, though. Because, I mean, we both – you go into it for, you know – but people had to be suggesting it to you.
My whole life I heard it because I had, like, a 30-year-old sense of humor as a 5-year-old.
Well, that's like me. That's what happened to me.
You're a man-child.
Exactly.
So the joke of it is, yes, we've both collectively – we probably own the 2-man record for high school class favorites.
Those little
stupid superficial things. You win like funniest guy or biggest storyteller.
Yeah, class clown.
Yeah, we won like 15 of them between us. And let's be clear, it is not an indicator of future success.
No, it's not. Absolutely.
You won most likely to succeed.
I did.
And you're sitting here with Jimmy Fallon on a Friday night. But the point is, just having some fun with you. But the point is, we were those people. And yes, I think our whole lives told us to get into show business.
Yeah.
But it takes more than that. It takes a climactic point, and we're going to ask you about yours now. It takes a climactic point where you've officially just shoved all of reality out of the way, and you've deluded yourself into entering something where the odds of succeeding are infinitesimal. Because there's a lot of delusion that has to go into, you know, starting in show business.
Absolutely, yeah.
Because the odds of you making it are so non-existent, and even worse, the odds of you prospering personally only because plenty of people make it bottom out, get killed. So where was your moment? Because my moment was I knew after watching Steve Robbins' mom at a play that this would be a cool thing to do with my mom. Like, I always wanted to do it. People had always said you should do it, or you're a comedian, haha. But it took my mom, me wanting my mom to have somewhere to go for me to actually do it.
Yeah.
What was yours?
Okay, well, I kind of was the type of kid in high school who was doing it already.
Uh-huh, okay.
Like, I was class president, and I used to host things, and I was already doing stand-up in school. And I used to think to myself, like, I really like doing this.
Uh-huh.
But I also was a guy who was acting
You were
getting on stage already, you know. But it never quite occurs to you, like, how does one start to do stand-up comedy? And it was like this thing where I was like, oh, my God, I'd love to do that. But how do you even approach that,
you know? Yeah.
And there was a point where I went to a – it's where I met the producer of our show, Ken Wood.
Okay.
I went to an acting – let's make a long story short. I went to an acting class, and the first thing the teacher said to me when I got on stage was, are you a stand-up comic? Because you feel like a stand-up comic to me.
Wow.
And I never forgot that, so that when I hit a point where, you know, you go on a lot of auditions as an actor, right?
Uh-huh.
And I just hated the material that I was doing because I'm like, I don't want to do other people's material.
So
like,
painful.
Why do I want to do something that somebody else wrote that I hate and I have to beg for the part?
Yeah.
And at a point of complete frustration, a friend of mine who always was one of those guys that supported me said, you should do stand-up comedy. It's like you already are that type of
person. You have a point of view. Uh-huh. You know, and you're funny, and like, so figure out how to do it. So I took a class at the Learning Annex, which was the Damn. Junkiest class, the only thing I could afford at the time.
Yeah.
But at the end, they said you'll get up on stage at Stand Up New York.
Wow.
And do your set in front of an audience. And I thought, well, that's all I really need to do, and I'll figure out how to do this. And I forget even the name of the teacher at the class. It was uh-huh. the junkiest class you could ever take. It was the saddest group of people you've ever seen, including uh-huh. myself. But he gave us this exercise. It said, write down 50 things you love and 50 things you hate.
Mm-hmm.
And that was how you began to generate material.
Wow.
And you would start reading down your list, and you'd get to something, and he'd say, okay, stop. Okay, now talk about that for a minute. And you would find inevitably that as you started speaking about something, you would stumble upon punchlines.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? And so that was like something that I started to figure out, like, oh, I see how you write material. Mm-hmm. I get it now. So I took none of his suggestions, and I went through it all, and it started to unlock that I was like, oh, stand up is about strong point of view.
Uh-huh.
And punchlines are like, it's like the underline, the emphasis. It's like the leap in an idea.
Yes.
You know, and you start to put those pieces together, and you start naturally learning. I mean, so anyway, so that was like how I got into
Wow.
stand up. And so the turning point.
You're doing it.
So next thing I know, I was doing it. And next thing I know, I was barking and
hanging out with me.
Hanging out with you.
Next thing you know, we were sleeping with homeless women. we arrived. I was working that aforementioned shady telemarketing job. And I just decided I was going to do it. I'm like, I got to get out of this job. It's fraud. It's like, I'm going to get killed for this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, at the moment I realized it was a fraud and it wasn't a real job, I'm like, all right, I can't do this anymore. I got to leave. And I knew I'd always wanted to do comedy. So I literally called up Caroline's and said, like, yeah, you know, I'm a comedian. I want to get on stage. They're like, yeah, we have a comedy school. And I was like, oh, I had heard about that. Can you put me in touch with the guy? And they said, yeah, his name is Andy Engel.
Oh, Andy Engel.
So this conversation takes place. I'm not kidding. I once called Andy Engel from 38,000 feet. I was flying in a man's private jet from New York to Las Vegas. It was the scene in The Girlfriend Experience, Brian Koppelman, Steven Soderbergh film,
sure,
where the personal trainer gets to go on a social trip to Vegas.
Uh-huh.
I was flying in someone's private plane,
mm-hmm.
and I called Andy Engel from this guy's phone and said, I want to take your class. I'm actually going to quit my job tomorrow. How do I start? And he was like, whoa. You can't quit your job. He's like, I don't care what it is. He's like, you can't quit your job.
Yeah.
He's like, that's not how comedy works. Which is funny to have Andy Engel as the voice of restraint.
I know, telling
you're
you
trying to hand him money.
Yeah.
You know, if you know anything about Andy Engel,
he's
a good guy.
Well, that was the whole thing. If you quit your job, you wouldn't have any money to give him.
Yeah, that's the point. He's like, don't quit your job. You got to pay for the class.
Yeah.
He's like, get through the next pay cycle at least. And then I explained to Andy what the job was, and then he had like the hearts in his eyes
uh-huh.
because I explained to him like, yeah, you know, I kind of fly back and forth to casinos. I get free rooms. I stay in penthouses. I got girls with me everywhere I go. It's kind of annoying. But there's always a supermodel around that wants to have sex.
Like, right.
And he was like, wait, what? And he's like, yeah, you can take the class for free. I want to be your friend.
Yeah.
Because that's Andy.
Right.
Smart, opportunistic guy. And, you know, people have opinions of Andy. Mine has always been a positive one because I've always liked him for the reasons other people don't like him. Meaning I understand what it means to be a producer, okay? People can find him to be very persistent and aggressive and like, you're going to do the show, you know what I mean? I always got that because I understood to be a producer, you had to be that guy. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Andy is great at his job.
And a phenomenal businessman.
A great businessman.
Right now, I mean, the fact that you took a comedy class
mm-hmm.
is attributable to Andy Engel because he had the first one.
Oh.
He started this whole thing.
He did. Oh,
yeah,
that's amazing.
He was
amazing.
A comic back in the 80s and had the presence of mind to do this. He was like, you know, there's enough guys out there that want to do
this.
That's
really smart.
Let's make money. And he was a genius businessman, you know. And people don't know Andy. Like, guys, he's just a persistent, naggy guy because he has to be to produce shows. But if you hang out with Andy, and Andy likes your act, the thing about Andy is, and I actually get into him in my book in a weird way, is that he's one of those guys where if he thinks your act is good, he will absolutely positively stop trying to make money off you and feed you to the right people. And in a weird way, the minimal amount of success I've enjoyed, some of it is attributable to him
mm-hmm.
because there were road bookers or club owners that he was like, you got to check this kid out. And like, instead of being like, do my bringer show, make me money.
Yeah.
I was like, wow, it was really nice of him. And I knew it got to the point that it was driven based on my act because in the beginning, when I had all of those perks because of that other job, they quickly dried up. And I started getting these suggestions like 4 years later when I had evolved as an act. He wasn't doing it when I sucked.
Right.
He was doing it when I was kind of okay at it, kind of proficient. So that's what happened to me. I went from I'm making $1 gazillion, so I'm going to do a comic. The next thing you know, we're staring at each other on opposite sides of 46th and Broadway.
Right, right.
Good living. And that's kind of where we are now, folks, is that, yeah, you jump cut ahead. There's a baby involved.
Yeah.
We're still doing comedy. We're doing this show. It's about to be nationally. It's about to be a live show nationally.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd say we didn't do terribly bad.
No.
But we got a lot in store. You know, a lot going on. And I will say this. It's really weird about stand-up comedy. But it's everything you, the listener, are trying to do in your life. It's all just a game of persistence. If you're willing to keep showing up, by default, you will get there. Because every day that you're willing to keep showing up, 4 or 5 people stop being willing to show up.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have any level of talent, stand-up comedy is not so much predicated on talent as it is discipline.
Yeah.
The funniest comedians on stage are the lamest people off stage.
Yeah.
Because most of them have really intelligent brains and a ton of personal discipline,
mm-hmm.
and they're willing to keep writing, editing, and just work the math together for the perfect comedy formula.
Yep.
You know, the funniest people you ever meet off stage, a lot of them don't go the furthest in life because they don't need the validation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people always say, like, the saddest guy to be around is Robin Williams in a sense that he never stops telling jokes even if he's off stage. And it's only sad because, like, you know, he just wants the approval.
I met him at Charlie Rose.
Oh, my God. How was he?
He never stopped telling jokes.
Ever, right? Like, you go to break and he's still going.
To the point where it was exhausting everybody.
Danny Vitale once told me, mm-hmm. Dan Vitale, famous guy, former SNL cast member for a short stint. And he once told me he was at an AA meeting with Robin Williams.
Right.
And that they were outside having a smoke break.
And if anybody's listening, that has to be in complete confidence.
Yeah. Oh, shit.
No. It's okay. Keep going.
Larry, that's it. We're going to sue.
And he said they were outside having a smoke break. And he said it was physically impossible to have a conversation because he kept whatever anyone said, he riffed into a joke and act out a sketch. He sang, he danced, he hopped around.
Yeah.
And he said it was, like, difficult to be around.
Yeah, and I used to love Robin Williams, you know, but it's true. I was surprised. I was like, I didn't know it carried off, like, in life like that.
Wow. No, that's what it did. And it's amazing. So you went from comedy, you know, in Charlie Rose and Howard Stern, and, of course, you had a storied screenwriting career with me.
Oh, yeah.
For those of you who don't know, Dean and I have written 2 screenplays, one of which had a wild run through Hollywood circles. It's in my book, so we don't want to give away too much.
No.
But, you know, one of which enjoyed a ton of success.
Mm-hmm.
And one of which mortally offended the guy we wrote it for.
Sure.
That is not in my book because it took place after the window of my book being
written.
Yeah. But we've had 2 of those. And, you know, what can I say? We're now here. We're here before you, the listener,
mm-hmm.
getting ready to embark the week of September the 2nd. That's Labor Day weekend.
Labor Day weekend.
So after Jenny's famous Labor Day barbecue comes and goes,
mm-hmm.
if we're not incarcerated, if we haven't been sexed into one of her various Latino gangs that she fraternizes with, we're going to be doing this show live for you, the listener, 5 days a week. That's going to go on this show. You'll not only hear myself 5 days a week, but you'll hear the great Dean Imperial, the pride of Randolph, New Jersey.
Yeah.
The one-time darling of Howard Stern.
Uh-huh.
The cover operative for the great Charlie Rose. A storied high school yearbook award recipient.
Right.
One closer on that, we had something called Senior Emmy Night where we passed out the awards. We had you had presenters in each category, uh-huh. and the nominees and stuff. I got suspended on the day of the show. For no reason, physically no reason, and they told my mom that they were just afraid to let me go on stage, not because they thought I was going to be funny, but so much that they thought I might use some lewd subject matter.
Wow, that's crazy.
And to be fair, I did not have any lewd subject matter. I still own the material to this day, and it's probably half of the reason I got into stand-up is because I felt cheated by never getting to do those lines.
Oh, wow.
And Steve Robbins, the kid I discussed earlier, received all 5 of my awards for me.
On your behalf?
On my behalf.
Oh, wow.
And the show ended with a rousing finale of the whole school chanting my name.
I wasn't there. Oh, wow.
But my mom was there and she wept.
Oh, man.
So that was my foray.
Where were you?
I was home. I was suspended from school. I mean, I wasn't allowed into the actual ceremony. So this is, you know, 1995. No one could text me. There was no Facebook. I didn't find out the story till the next morning.
Oh, wow.
Like, I got to school, and everybody was like my buddy, and I was like, hey, and they kind of told me. So it was interesting. You know, yours was a little more conventional, but you won all the big prizes.
Yeah. No. I mean, you know, it's funny because you don't realize what a punchline they become later in life.
Well, the greatest, we've always had this discussion that what might be the greatest screenplay ever is a screenplay called Most Likely to Succeed.
Yeah.
Because you can just jump cut from that award presentation to a guy doing what we're doing.
I think of it every time I use the Coinstar machine. You ever use the Coinstar machine and they've got that condescending little like female, like that little cartoon that says like, hi, I'm Penny.
Oh,
you sure seem like you've got a lot of change today. I'm like, I want to kill myself. Most likely to succeed.
Woo!
Yeah.
Well, if it's any consolation, I spent 2 years driving a cab for 60 hours.
There you go.
I took Ferraris and Mercedes and custom-built cars and parlayed them into a yellow Ford Crown Victoria.
Oh, there you go.
Thank you, showbiz.
Right.
But we're back, folks. You're listening to the show right now because you are part of a revolution. And what you're about to invest in emotionally by being a part of the show is a pretty interesting story, because we're these two guys. We're sitting here at the age of 36. You know, we got some minimal TV credits now. We got a book coming out that people seem to be excited about. It got a lot of great celebrity endorsements that you'll see on the back cover. But we're going to basically sit here in this studio and take the show you've been listening to 5 days a week and attempt to turn it into a national powerhouse. Now, we have listeners all over the world. That's already known. Supposedly, we have 10,000 of you. But we're now going to go live and get broadcast everywhere in the country. Cars, radios, internet, phones, podcasts, the works. And we may pull it off. We may not pull it off.
Uh-huh.
But at least now you know who's attempting it. And that was the point of this episode.
There you go.
Dean and I will be back doing Off the Meter on Monday, the 19th day of August.
Yep.
And we will basically be executing the final days of Off the Meter as you know it now, which is a one-hour-a-day show that's played all over the world and, you know, features some interesting news commentary and some fun guests. It's about to turn into something else, folks.
Mm-hmm.
I won't say much more than that, but I will say we seem to be in favor with the powers that be.
Yep.
Which means you, my friend, you, the listener, are in for a hell of a ride. So don't go anywhere. A big, fat, special thanks to you, Mr. Imperial.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
It was fun because we did a Getting to Know You episode in which I spoke for 40 minutes about myself. I really was. I found myself saying this earlier in the week. I really was the guy who wore white to some woman's wedding.
Well, I guess the theme was Charlie Rose. He does talk a lot in his interviews, but that's all right.
Well,
that's why we love him.
And we're hungry.
So,
folks, I thank you for being a part of my vacation for 5 consecutive days this week.
Uh-huh.
I thank everybody that was willing to lend me their time. The great Carl Gottlieb, Nick Leffley of Maxim Magazine fame, Mike Edison of Screw Magazine fame, Jenny Fela of Just Screwing fame. I mean, who's not familiar with her work in the tri-state area? Let's be fair. And, of course, my co-pilot, Tower 2, as they say. The Twin Towers are back, ladies and gentlemen.
That's right.
And you're on the ground floor, so don't go anywhere. Thanks for listening. This is the best we can do. We'll be right back.
me fail.
I enjoyed it. It was an unbelievably interesting experience.